Welcome to Lymphoma CLL Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Stephen Ansell, and to begin, I asked him to talk about what we know today about one of the most fascinating recent developments in hematologic oncology, the rapidly evolving role of checkpoint inhibitor immunotherapy in the management of Hodgkin lymphoma.
The interesting thing about Hodgkin lymphoma is that when you look at those ligands, PD-L1 and PD-L2, they are sky high on the tumor cells, much more so than other types of tumors. And work done by Margaret Shipp and others from Dana-Farber have shown that there are actually genetic amplifications happening at the chromosome 9p24.1 locus. And what that means is that that genetic locus is so ramped up and so many copies are made that the tumor cell then translates that into protein and makes a huge amount of PD-L1 and PD-L2 on the tumor cell surface. That makes it very difficult for activated T cells to really be able to target those cells very effectively. So that might be one of the reasons why the efficacy of PD-1 blockade is so good in Hodgkin lymphoma, because clearly this mechanism now that's genetically driven is a primary reason why these cells are protected against the immune system.
So you said there's a lot of PD-1, and I don't know, at least one thing that clinically now clinicians are hearing about is the TPS score on the assay that's being done with pembrolizumab in lung cancer. So, I mean, just as an example. So, for example, there you have to have 50% in order to use it first line. It goes up to 100%. For example, where would Hodgkin fit in on that kind of platform, 100%?
Yeah, so Hodgkin probably, if you could go even higher, it would be, because if you even just look at the intensity of staining by immunohistochemistry, it is extremely bright in contrast to other kinds of cancer where it's positive, but clearly log levels lower. So I think this is, again, a really unique disease where the expression is extremely high relative to other cancers. And I think that actually means that we don't quite understand to the same degree what's actually happening with the biology in Hodgkin lymphoma because of this very, very high expression of PD-L1 and PD-L2. It may even have a different role aside from just suppressing the immune system.
Any way you can sort of bring in kind of the classic thinking about Hodgkin lymphoma in terms of the isolated Reed-Sternberg cells, you know, histologically, does that sort of sync up with, you know, what we're learning biologically?
I think it does to some degree. I think the uniqueness of Hodgkin lymphoma is that you just have 1 to 2% of all the cells in the tumor are the Reed-Sternberg cell, and all the other cells are inflammatory cells that are really recruited there by cytokines and chemokines and other kind of immune active proteins that recruit these immune cells into the tumor. So all it would take is just modest interference with that whole sort of environment and just a modest targeting of tumor cells, and you shut down this very vibrant community, as it were, of all of these immune cells and get a significant response. So that, I think, is what's happening with PD-1, PD-L1 interactions being blocked by nivolumab and pembrolizumab, is the balance is just being tipped to even a small, modest degree, and all of this very active immune system just shuts down.
How do you sort of see EBV in Hodgkin lymphoma as part of, again, this whole concept?
Well, there's been, again, some good work done that has actually looked at EBV and the fact that the EBV virus is incorporated into the genome of the Reed-Sternberg cell. And by doing that, actually results in activation of a variety of pathways, also specifically the STAT pathway. And when that happens, that results in upregulation and increased expression of PD-L1 and PD-L2. So that's another mechanism where PD-L1 and PD-L2 are overexpressed in Hodgkin. But it is interesting that when you go back and look at a various series where pembrolizumab and nivolumab have been used, it's actually a minority of the cases that have EBV positivity. It really appears to be the main event is this genetic amplification that drives the PD-L1 and PD-L2.
In terms of this really interesting genetic alteration that you were talking about in the chromosome and the resultant huge levels of PD-1, where else has this been seen? And specifically, I think I've heard that it was seen in primary mediastinal large cell lymphoma.
Yes, it has been. Again, studies done in Hodgkin lymphoma have shown that it's really almost universal, so virtually every case is true. However, when you start to go to other diseases, large cell lymphoma, some low-grade lymphomas, some T-cell lymphomas, and then, as you mentioned, primary mediastinal large B-cell lymphoma, and you look for this translocation, it is present, but the numbers really drop down as to how many of them have the amplification. And I think there is something pretty unique about the amplification, because the patients with these amplifications tend to do very well with PD-1 blockade, a little different to other similar diseases that don't have that, where I think the biology is a lot more like melanoma and other solid tumor cases.
That's fascinating. I have to ask you also, because this is something I've kind of asked people about over the years a few times, and that is, do you see any sort of correlation between the healing process, wound healing, for example, and cancer?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There is data around chronic inflammation and the risk of increasing likelihood of developing cancers. Whether that be wound healing or that being chronic inflammation related to autoimmune and other kinds of processes, a chronic inflammatory process that won't resolve basically increases a lot of the immune activity and potentially increases the likelihood of errors either from the immune cells themselves or with immune surveillance.
I was thinking more sort of pathogenically. Do you think that in some way, you know, the process, the carcinogenic process, metastasis, et cetera, in some way involves alterations in pathways of healing?
I think that is to some degree true, because if you look at immune checkpoint therapy, normally what would happen is if you developed an infection, T cells rush to the site, get the infection under control, and you don't want them to remain active for an extended period of time thereafter. You want them to shut down. So after they've seen the antigen for an extended period, they start upregulating PD-1 and TIM-3 and LAG-3 and other molecules as part of their "you can shut me down, I'm done" kind of messaging. And then they get shut down by macrophages that express PD-L1 and PD-L2. The problem in cancer is if that process kind of gets hijacked and the tumors have a lot of PD-L1 and PD-L2 and effectively shut down the immune response before its time, that's where the problem lies.
Can you talk a little bit about your 26-year-old man?
This was actually one of the first patients to go on the original phase 1 trial of nivolumab, and this was a very gratifying patient story. This gentleman had been through a lot of therapy and, in fact, had been told by his home oncologist that they were entirely out of options, and he was being sent to hospice. And his mom actually called down to say, look, is there anything that he could still be considered for? And we had just opened the phase 1 trial. And he had such large adenopathy that he really couldn't even put his arms down entirely because of big adenopathy in his axillae. But he got treated and within 6 weeks had a dramatic response. This is a patient who then remained on nivolumab for 2 years and remained in remission. Per protocol, he actually stopped. There was some degree of disease reactivation about 8 to 10 months later, and he got restarted, and he's been back in remission and now is approaching 3.5 to 4 years on treatment.
So, you know, it's interesting. I'm now three interviews in a row that I've heard cases of people who are about to go to hospice who went into major remissions from checkpoint inhibitors. And the idea of somebody considering hospice and then, you know, feeling great and looking back on that, I just can't even imagine what it must be like. Tell me what it's like to be a physician in that situation.
You know, to be honest, that's one of the main reasons I come to work most days, because it's extremely gratifying to see patients that have been in bad shape who then really benefit from therapy. And I think what is even more gratifying is, you know, I position myself as someone who brings new therapies to the clinic as kind of what my goal in my career is. And it's extremely gratifying to see biology translating into clinical benefit for patients, and particularly when it's been as dramatic as some of the immune checkpoint therapy, in particularly Hodgkin lymphoma, where it has been very impressive in a very high percentage of patients.
So just to continue on, since we started out with Hodgkin lymphoma, can you kind of provide, you know, sort of an update on where we are in terms of clinical research, response rates, what line that's been looked at, duration of response, and in particular, trials that are ongoing and where you see things heading?
Right. So I think when you're looking at immune checkpoint therapy, initial phase 1 trials of both nivolumab and pembrolizumab in Hodgkin lymphoma were very promising. Response rates in the 65 to about 85% range. Then there were two confirmatory large phase 2 trials, again of nivolumab and pembrolizumab. And it was extremely gratifying to see that the high response rate was maintained in those trials. And those trials were actually just recently updated in the 2016 ASH meeting. And the exciting thing was response rates, again, high 68-65% range and very durable. And so with follow-up that now extends toward 18 months, 2 years, patients are continuing to benefit. And I think what is also good is analysis, particularly from the pembrolizumab trials, have looked at primary refractory patients as well as patients who had failed treatment after initially responding. And responses are seen across the board, and the response rates are high in all groups. So there isn't a population, it seems at this time, of patients in the relapse setting who don't benefit from the therapy. It seems to benefit most patients almost across the board.
When you look at these patients, let's say 1 to 2 years later, how many have not had progressive disease?
So I would say, again, if you started with 100 patients and 65% of them have a good response, some have still benefit even though they didn't even achieve a partial remission and may continue to benefit. But in general, more than 50% of the patients continue in remission even when you get out to about 2 years and following after that. Some patients have come off from toxicity and some have come off from progressive disease. Toxicity being often issues with some pneumonitis and other kinds of autoimmune, as it were, reactions.
Do you think that this is going to be a shoulder? Of course, nobody really knows, but I mean, do you think some of these people are cured?
That, I think, is an excellent question, and I don't think we know the answer to that just yet. But I will say that we have patients who have completed the treatment at 2 years in a complete remission or in a very good partial remission for whom treatment was stopped, and now with up to a year's follow-up beyond that, still in remission and not retreated. So I'm very optimistic that we will see a population of people that are cured. I think we have to be honest, though. There are some, when we stop treatment, who then have disease come back, get retreated, as in the case we just discussed, and benefit again. So I think we're going to have two groups. We're going to have the potentially cured, but we may also have patients who will need intermittent retreatment.
How do you feel about the idea of stopping therapy in a patient in a good remission, 2 years, 3 years, you know, assuming the patient's tolerating it? Do you think it would be reasonable to consider stopping?
You know, I think that's an issue that we are going to need to address. One, I feel personally pretty comfortable with that because we have experience of retreating patients and being able to get them back into remission. So I think that's good. I think the cost is obviously going to be something that in time will need to be addressed because sort of indefinite treatment is going to be hard to sustain. But on the other hand, I also want to be honest that I think patients find it a little difficult to accept the I'm going to stop, particularly if you highlight patients that have been very sick, now for the first time are really doing well and are very anxious about potentially going back to very sick all over again.
Any particular tolerability issues that you've observed that are different than what's been seen in solid tumors, for example, that kind of play out the same way?
I think in general, we could say that patients with Hodgkin have tolerated the treatment very similarly to the patients with solid tumors. There hasn't been a very different toxicity signal. And in fact, actually, because of the efficacy, particularly in Hodgkin lymphoma, of nivolumab, pembrolizumab alone, patients haven't required the combination studies that include ipilimumab, where clearly the toxicity then steps up a level. So actually, majority of patients tolerate this treatment very well and often have been quite sick from their disease, and then the net is actually a significant gain when all is done because their disease symptoms are so much better.
Any particular complications that you've observed or heard about that you want to comment on? I'm always curious about hypophysitis. Have you ever seen that?
Interestingly, I've seen that much more commonly with ipilimumab than I've seen it with nivolumab and pembrolizumab. Pembrolizumab and nivolumab in general, the side effects we deal with most are moderate pneumonitis, hypothyroidism, some bowel symptoms potentially, but quite frankly, diarrhea and shortness of breath, cough, and pneumonitis as detected on a scan or an x-ray are some of the things that we work with the most. It's been interesting because many patients with some anti-inflammatory treatment in the way of steroids can often still maintain and stay on treatment even with the symptoms, but one has to really kind of navigate that quite carefully.
So again, a question I've been asking people in different fields. Have you encountered any patients with prior autoimmune disease? And what is your thinking about using checkpoint inhibitors in various types of autoimmune disease?
In general, most of the clinical trials were very cautious about that in heme malignancies, and actually most of them were excluded. Now, obviously, as there's greater experience and availability of these agents, there's much more kind of willingness to try it out. My sense is that not all autoimmune diseases are the same. So, for example, you know, we've had patients that have had diseases like psoriasis, which you could argue is not exactly an autoimmune disease, and we have not seen much in the way of difficulty tolerating checkpoint inhibitors in patients like that. But if you have a patient with a severe rheumatoid arthritis or some other true inflammatory process, I think one still has to be very cautious about that. And I personally have not had much experience treating those patients. We've been very careful not, because we've done a lot of the trials, not to enroll those patients.
I did hear from Jean-Charles Soraya in a lung cancer symposium about a patient who ended up in the ICU with psoriasis, but I guess it's pretty uncommon.
Well, interestingly, you know, we also have a similar problem in that we actually see a lot of patients that have had an allogeneic transplant.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, from, you know, Hodgkin that's been a therapy, and then they now would like to try an immune checkpoint. And the question is that a safe strategy? And actually now there are data that have come out that have allowed us to say that in general, provided you don't have clear-cut clinical GVHD at the time of being enrolled in or being treated with an immune checkpoint, actually a lot of patients have been able to be treated quite safely. There are a number of patients that have had some toxicity, but I think if one is careful to ensure that graft versus host disease is well controlled, you can potentially give that if you need to.
You know, if you could design a trial that would look at the use of checkpoint inhibitors in the way that you think would be optimal, and maybe there are trials like that right now, I'm curious what it would be. And, you know, like I wonder, for example, if anybody ever thought about maybe doing trials of starting out with a checkpoint inhibitor or checkpoint inhibitor and bevacizumab before you even do chemotherapy. Any sort of fantasies about what the ideal way is to utilize chemo, bevacizumab, and checkpoint inhibitors?
Actually, interesting you asked that question, and it isn't fantasy because it's actually happening. So there are actually a number of trials, one in elderly patients, because as well you would know, Hodgkin lymphoma and particularly ABVD and other therapies are poorly tolerated in the elderly. So there is actually now a corporate trial and a investigator-initiated trial of brentuximab vedotin and nivolumab as frontline therapy for elderly patients or patients that have cardiac issues making ABVD impossible. And that study is actually ongoing at the moment. And really, to the best of my knowledge, the therapies appear well tolerated in the limited number of patients that have been treated. And then, as you also mentioned, there's an arm of the corporate study that was testing nivolumab that has tested 4 doses of nivolumab as first treatment for advanced stage Hodgkin patients, followed by 6 cycles of ABVD. And we're waiting on those results to see, one, whether it's more effective, but also how effective the 4 doses on its own as first-line therapy before any chemotherapy was for patients with Hodgkin lymphoma.
It reminds me of some of the neoadjuvant studies, you know, you see in solid tumors and HER2-positive breast cancer, et cetera. So, wow, really interesting. I wanted to ask you about a couple of papers you were involved with. We were talking about bevacizumab, and I want to just get your take on a couple of these. One is a paper in Blood, 5-year survival and durability results of bevacizumab in patients with relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma. What did you all look at there?
Right. So we spoke a little earlier about the fact that are there potentially a population of patients who receive novel agents and could be cured? And I think in brentuximab vedotin-treated patients, there is this population. And that was the point of the paper, was really to look at 5 years on, after patients had failed initial treatment, failed an autologous transplant, and then got brentuximab vedotin, you know, the efficacy of that agent in that space was 75% response rate with about a 30% complete response. And the complete responding patients seem to be the patients that do best. And the question was, how well do they do? Because there seemed to be a population of patients that we're now out 5 years and beyond still in remission. And that was the point of that publication. When you take all patients and you go, how well is that tail doing? There's about a 20% of the entire population that are still in remission now, 5+ years beyond initial treatment. So the question is just, those patients look for all the world like they could be cured. And so I think that's an important piece of information as we weigh up the benefits of checkpoint inhibitors and brentuximab vedotin and other agents, is to know that you could, in a complete responding patient, expect in a subset potentially cure.
You know, I'm not sure that really is well appreciated outside the investigator world, because, you know, people don't see that many patients with relapsed Hodgkin's disease in practice. And I've always been curious about that idea with B-vedotin. Any thoughts, you know, theoretically, biologically, about what differentiates these 20% with these incredible responses versus everybody else?
You know, I think it comes back to the biology, remembering again that CD30 is very highly expressed on the Reed-Sternberg cells. So if your targeted agent, brentuximab vedotin, really delivers a knockout punch to those small number of Reed-Sternberg cells, the entire house of cards, as it were, with all of these immune cells collapses. And if there aren't Reed-Sternberg cells remaining to build it back up, you could potentially be cured. And I think those are the patients who are having this long, durable remission.
Let's take a deep breath and jump into follicular for a minute. Can you talk a little bit about your 47-year-old lady with follicular lymphoma?
Right. So this is a patient initially diagnosed with follicular grade 2, stage 4A. She had lots of lymph nodes. She had a 5% bone marrow involvement. And as we typically would do, even though she did have bone marrow involvement and did have lymph nodes, the burden of disease was actually quite low. So we initially observed her, but slowly over time, there clearly was disease progression. And back at that time, we were using a lot of radioimmunotherapy, and she, as first-line treatment, received radioimmunotherapy as her treatment. She responded very nicely, had a very good partial response, and the response was quite durable for about 2 years. At that point, she had evidence of disease progression and got treated with bendamustine plus rituximab, received 6 cycles, had a nice remission, complete remission, was then treated with maintenance rituximab. But actually, while she was on maintenance, some of her disease began to recur, rebiopsied, still shown to be follicular grade 2 non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and was then started on treatment with adalimumab. And actually, she benefited again from adalimumab and has been on treatment for 11 months, maintained on that therapy.
She had an objective response?
She did. So she was a partial response to adalimumab, yes.
And any tolerability issues with the adalimumab?
Well, again, one of the things that we look for, obviously, are watching to see if there is anything in the way of pneumonitis or diarrhea or any kind of liver problems and the like. And she actually was one of the patients that tolerated this very well. When I say very well, it still does interfere with your eating and how hungry you feel and the like. So she generally kind of over time tolerated better. But as far as severe toxicities requiring discontinuation of therapy, she didn't have any problems with that.
As long as we're talking about immune therapy, I'm kind of curious. I've kind of heard, or, you know, we know that the problems that have occurred with adalimumab and I guess other PI3 kinase inhibitors are, quote, immune related. They may be delayed. What's the biology of, you know, PI3 kinase inhibition as it relates to these immune things?
Well, it's interesting, you know, the PI3 kinase pathway and the mTOR pathway have a significant role in tumor cells, that's why we use it, but they also have a significant role in immune cells, particularly T cells. So when you interfere with that pathway, you will actually change the regulation of T cells and how they function. And so we're finding that a number of these agents, and just to remind people, an mTOR inhibitor, which is kind of a little further downstream of that whole pathway, rapamycin is used as an anti-rejection therapy for different transplant scenarios. So the PI3 kinase pathway is very relevant for T cell function. So interestingly, when you inhibit that, clearly you're going to inhibit the malignant cell, but you're going to modulate and change the function of T cells. And what we found is that earlier in the disease course you use these agents, when the immune system is still much more functional, before it's very beaten up by heavy-duty chemotherapy, that's when there's a substantially greater risk that your immune system is activated in an unfavorable fashion and you get problems such as colitis, pneumonitis, various skin issues, infection problems, and the like.
And before we get into some of the other issues related to follicular lymphoma, I am curious about your observation, particularly in terms of adalimumab, but also this whole class of agents. I mean, this patient seemed like she had a good benefit, good response from treatment, but there have been a lot of concerns. Obviously, it's approved also with CLL about toxicity. Where do you think these agents are heading? I know there are others. There's copanlisib. Do you think others may be, you know, more beneficial? Or is this all just going to kind of go away and we're going to be doing new things?
So I do think that's a good question, and it's actually quite a complicated one, because I do think there are going to be ways to use this class of agents in populations of patients at lower risk so that we don't actually pick the patients at high risk develop side effects and toxicities. And the new agents may actually be better at really kind of targeting the malignant cell with less off-target effects on other cells. But I do think it's a crowded field with lots of other agents all competing for similar space. And toxicity is obviously something that bothers treating physicians quite substantially. So if you have two agents that look very similar in efficacy, but their toxicity profiles are very different, one being easy and one being a lot harder, that does really drive people to use the agents that are easier to give.
So reflecting back on this case, when you first presented her and you mentioned that, you know, she was observed for 15 months but still had a lot of disease, I was wondering, I don't know, at that point, you know, people evolve over time about how they treat patients. But nowadays, are there situations where you use rituximab monotherapy alone in patients with FL?
Right. I mean, in my practice, I kind of see follicular lymphoma as having three groups of patients. There is the first group of patients who are almost incidental pickups. They went in for a physical, they were noted to have a small lymph node or maybe something that bothered the physician, and a scan got done and they were found to have lymphadenopathy and follicular lymphoma is diagnosed. But they are really in excellent health, and once the staging is done, there really is a very low burden of disease with low in the way of risk factors for progression or problems. Those patients are people that even today we would still observe. There's a second population of folks who have a little bit more disease, maybe some modest symptoms, but also patients who are very anxious about the, I have cancer and you're just going to observe me. Those are the patients where I think a monoclonal antibody as single agent, rituximab with maintenance, is a consideration. And then the third group are clearly the people where there's not much doubt about the fact that they have a lot of disease, they have risks for, you know, organ dysfunction, and they have risks for further progression and are symptomatic. Those people we typically will use a chemoimmunotherapy combination.
So speaking of chemoimmunotherapy, of course, I don't get your take on the big plenary presentation at ASH looking at obinutuzumab chemo versus rituximab chemo. But before I do, I've got to ask you, though, this patient had radioimmune therapy. Are you still using radioimmune therapy? How many times in the last year have you sent a patient for radioimmune therapy with, you know, lymphoma?
We did a lot of the studies with that initially, so there's still members of our group that will still use that from time to time. But to be frank, I would say that in the last year, I might have treated one such patient and not many more. And part of it is just there's such a plethora of other agents with very similar efficacy, often also because the number of patients that have bone marrow involvement making the use of radioimmunotherapy, particularly if it's closer to the 20-25% mark, a little bit more hazardous, is quite high. And then the other thing is, personally, for radioimmunotherapy, the challenge often is if you give that therapy and it turns out that the patient doesn't benefit, the blood counts are low for an extended period of time. So you actually are kind of in a little bit of a hole as to what you can do next when you have low blood counts.
So what's your take on the obinutuzumab chemo paper? Maybe you can go through what you thought were the most important findings, the design, and kind of what you think it means.
So, I mean, this is interesting and exciting data. You know, this is looking at chemotherapy with obinutuzumab or rituximab followed by treating patients with obinutuzumab or rituximab for maintenance thereafter, showing an advantage for patients that received obinutuzumab. I guess the challenge is just twofold, and I think the first is that there were substantially more toxicities for the patients receiving obinutuzumab. I think in my mind, at this point, the takeaway from that particular study is that I think additional trials are needed. And part of that is just if you look at obinutuzumab-rituximab comparisons across the board, we're not seeing consistent results. Again, one of the things I would like to see personally is that most trials would show an advantage for one agent over another. But in some trials, the agents are identical. There is really no clear benefit. And then in one or two other trials, there is an advantage to using it. So for example, G-CHOP or obinutuzumab CHOP versus R-CHOP, the results are identical. So,
and you're talking about follicular? Or
no, this is enlarged cell.
Right, and that was also just reported at the same meeting.
Correct. So it's just, to me, interesting that whereas every trial when we looked at the use of rituximab versus no rituximab over the years, I think there might be one study that did not show an advantage, but very many other studies did. In this case, we're starting to see kind of a mixture. Sometimes there's a benefit, sometimes there's not. But in all of this, there is still quite a lot of additional side effects and infusion reactions and toxicities. So I think it hasn't yet got to the place where overall the consensus is it's better. I think we're still learning about it.
Although, I mean, seems like a lot of people think it might be better than rituximab and CLL.
And I think that's true. And I think the reason there is also to remember that rituximab's efficacy in CLL is very modest. So I think, you know, CLL may be quite different to non-Hodgkin lymphoma, where the efficacy of rituximab is a higher bar.
So, you know, it's interesting your thoughts about the toxicity. I've asked a number of people about this trial, and you're the first person who brought that up. Mostly what I've been hearing is the number of people who had to come off therapy was the same. It's mainly infusion reactions, and, you know, it's not that big a deal. Usually goes away after once, you know, not a deal breaker, so to speak. You seem to have a lot more concerns.
Well, I don't know that I would say I'm concerned. We give a lot of treatments that create a lot of toxicity. So I don't think people are scared of toxicities. And certainly, as I say, when one learns how to use agents, you find ways to work around the toxicities. But I do think that there are clearly more toxicities. And I think we just need to, at this point, still get a little more longer follow-up to see whether those translate into additional, you know, patients, as I say, coming off to the study and therefore not benefiting to the same degree. I think rituximab is a very easy to give treatment. So that's why it makes whatever new generation of agent a little harder to beat.
Anything coming down the line for follicular lymphoma, indolent lymphomas that you're excited about? I was going to ask you, we talked before about checkpoint inhibitors with Hodgkin lymphoma, if you could sort of provide an overview of what's been seen with non-Hodgkin lymphoma with checkpoint inhibitors, including follicular lymphoma, and any other novel agents or strategies that you're excited about.
So I think checkpoint inhibitors are now obviously being tested across the board, and there are a number of trials, phase two trials, looking at large cell lymphoma, looking at follicular lymphoma, looking at other indolent lymphomas, and those are all kind of in the process now of being reported. Some of them haven't actually been read out yet, but if we go back and say how effective would we expect them to be based on the preliminary data, the responses are kind of a lot lower than what we've seen in Hodgkin lymphoma. So in general, we've seen response rates more in the 20 to 40% range than the 60 to 70% range that we saw for Hodgkin lymphoma. And the durability may not be quite as long.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, I mean, those kinds of response rates are, you know, what you see in lung cancer and, you know, bladder, for example. But people get excited about it because, again, duration of response. You're saying that maybe not quite as impressive, or we don't really know yet.
I don't think we know completely yet because the numbers are small and the follow-up is insufficient. But I think you make a good point is that non-Hodgkin lymphoma, I think, is giving us data that looks a lot more like solid tumor data. And I think, as we mentioned earlier, Hodgkin lymphoma is a different animal, and I think we need to kind of set that aside. And I don't think we're going to see the same kind of results in other lymphomas as we saw in Hodgkin lymphoma.
Again, any novel agents in lymphomas or follicular lymphoma that you're excited about?
So I think there are a number of really interesting agents. I think the exciting part is combining these agents. So there are a variety of different trials using immunologically active agents with antibodies, using immune checkpoints with ways to modulate that. So I think those are all really exciting. I think an area I'm kind of interested in watching, and that is ways now to utilize not the adaptive immune system like we would use with immune checkpoints, but the innate immune system, so targeting macrophages and monocytes. So there's a lot of antibodies targeting the CD47, SIRP alpha, the don't eat me signal, and those in combination with antibodies could really prove quite promising. So those are very early in clinic. They're in really just in phase one clinical trials, but I think it'd be interesting to watch as you wake up the other side of the immune system, the macrophages, to see what you can do with that.
So I wanted to go through a couple more of your cases, and in terms of novel therapies, always interested to hear about CAR T cell therapy and what's going on. And you have this 55-year-old man, maybe you can talk about him.
Right, so this is a gentleman with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who has the activated B-cell phenotype, stage 3A to begin with, was treated originally with R-CHOP chemotherapy, but already at cycle number 4 showed evidence of progression. biopsied him, still showed the same histology, then got treated with our typical salvage treatment, was treated with rice chemotherapy, but by the second cycle, again, had disease progression. So wasn't able to proceed to an autologous transplant because of primary refractory disease. And we had a clinical trial with CAR T cells available for patients with the primary refractory disease. So he was enrolled in the clinical trial. We gave him the conditioning treatment with fludarabine and cyclophosphamide, tolerated that well. He got the infusion of the CAR T cells, initially tolerated that extremely well, but as is typical, 2 to 3 days later, began to develop a fever, then developed the cytokine-type symptoms, was treated with tocilizumab and then with some steroids, but really did require admission to hospital, then admission to the ICU. Quite suddenly developed some of the neurotoxicity that's seen, where suddenly he really couldn't find words and became quite confused. That's very distressing kind of symptom, but over time, with the supportive care and with the steroids and so on, these symptoms all improved. And restaging showed him to be in a complete response, and he remained in that complete response for 9 months. So in a patient where nothing had really kind of touched his disease to that point, the power of CAR T cells was pretty impressive.
What happened after that?
Unfortunately, at 9 months, he again developed additional new lymphadenopathy and has gone on to other treatment, on clinical trials for salvage of his relapse disease.
Can you comment a little bit more in general about this neurotoxicity? And when you work them up, what do you see on imaging? Anything in their cerebrospinal fluid? And what's going on?
So I think there's a lot of work still trying to be done to understand exactly why that is. And, this is a class effect in that other agents that activate T cells like blinatumomab and others will cause these types of symptoms too. So clearly the activation of the immune system, particularly the activation of T cells, has a profound role. And in the blinatumomab case, there was some discussion about understanding the ratios of Ts and B cells to try and predict that.
Is this like a cerebritis?
Well, interestingly, it actually seems to be largely cytokine mediated because the evaluation neurologically is actually quite bland. And a lot of the testing hasn't really shown clear-cut inflammatory changes that could point to just sort of treat with more steroids to shut it down.
How many patients have you treated or had who got CAR T cell therapy?
We actually were a little late to the game in this whole process. And so different to the groups at Memorial and the groups at the NCI and UPenn and the Hutch, we really kind of came in as the trials were being rolled out to more centers. So we've only treated in the 8 to 12 patient range. We haven't done as many as some of those other groups have done.
And what's the spectrum of what you've seen in terms of neurotoxicity? Does it always occur? Do you see milder variants?
So it doesn't always occur. I would say that this patient kind of uniquely could have highlighted all of the main symptoms. Interestingly, the patients that seem to have the best longer-term outcome are often the patients that had the most trouble during the infusion. So it may well be that the activation of things is really, a measure of how many of those CAR T cells were truly activated and targeting the tumor cells. So we've had some patients who tolerated extremely well with actually very little in the way of side effects at all. But some of those patients have actually been non-responding patients. And in other patients who've had more toxicity, they've more typically been the ones that have benefited. But there have been some that have gone through treatment quite well without a lot of problems.
That's interesting. In this man, how long did it take before he was completely back to normal? Neurologically?
About 2 to 3 weeks.
Interesting. Yeah, I've heard people say that sometimes they see patients who, they have trouble with their cell phones. It's more of a low-grade kind of thing than a fulminant type presentation. Have you seen that?
Yeah, so I think there is a distinct spectrum. There are just some people where clearly they're not quite as their usual sharp selves. They just struggle with sort of minimal tasks. And then there have been other patients who really were kind of very poorly responsive at all.
Can you kind of capsulize, roughly what's been seen in terms of efficacy, at least with lymphomas and CLL, with CAR T cell therapy, and where you think it's heading? And also, I know there have been some recent issues with deaths with one of the compounds. Can you sort of summarize what's going on?
So I think actually this is a very exciting field, and I think we have a lot to learn about exactly how to utilize it. So it's obviously a high risk but yet high reward field. And the reason I say it's high reward is many of the patients going on these trials are exactly like the patient I mentioned. Primary refractory disease, these patients have a dismal prognosis and are clearly benefiting and responding well. And the response rates are running in the kind of 40 to 50% range and even higher in some of the studies in very, very refractory patients. So I think that's where the excitement comes, is that in patients where our expectations were extremely low, we've got patients that are doing really quite well, way better than expected. However, we're pushing the envelope here quite clearly, because these therapies are really kind of activating the immune system in a way that we don't fully understand and sometimes don't have a very good handle on. And I tell patients it's a little bit like you have to walk very close to the edge of the cliff to get the benefit, and there is the risk that you could slip and go over if there are a lot of toxicities. So I think as we learn about this, if we really want to see this therapy benefit, we have to have some degree of willingness to run the risk of toxicity, because the patients that have the best outcome are often the ones with the most active immune systems, and those are the ones who have potentially the most side effects.
I wanted to ask you about T-cell lymphoma. You had this patient, a 61-year-old woman. Maybe we could talk about her.
Sure thing. So this is a 61-year-old female patient who has peripheral T-cell lymphoma, NOS, so not otherwise specified, a very common type. Stage 3A, treated with our standard CHOP chemotherapy and then consolidated by an autologous stem cell transplant in first remission. Within a year, had evidence of disease progression, rebiopsied, still shown to be PTCL-NOS, treated with romidepsin, but had disease progression. And then because this peripheral T-cell lymphoma patient did have evidence of CD30 expression on the tumor cells, we enrolled her in a clinical trial looking at brentuximab vedotin in these patients. And she had a nice response, partial response to treatment on brentuximab vedotin for an 8-month period, then had evidence of progression and has gone on to other therapies.
Any tolerability issues with the vedotin, any neuropathy?
So in general, you know, we've treated a lot of patients with brentuximab vedotin, and patients will tolerate it extremely well. But when they get up to about 8 to 12 doses, that's when the neuropathy begins to become more of an issue. And some patients have no neuropathy at all, but I would say the majority have some degree. And for some, the neuropathy can be quite debilitating. So we find that when you get to the 8 to 10 or 12 doses, it gets a little harder to keep giving.
Can you talk a little bit about how you approach CD30 testing and the use of vedotin in general with various types of lymphomas, including T-cell lymphoma?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting question, because the amount of CD30 expression that one needs to see actually is very modest. There have been a number of trials in large cell lymphoma and in T-cell lymphoma where they've looked at giving brentuximab vedotin. And in the large cell lymphoma trials, they didn't actually require that you showed how much CD30 expression there was, and just still needed to look and see how the responses differed between the people that were CD30 positive versus negative. And actually, they saw responses in the CD30 negative patients as well. So it seems like targeting helps the response rate be higher, but it isn't quite as essential, and it could also be that immunohistochemistry underappreciates CD30 expression, whereas something like flow cytometry could be a lot better. So in general, I think when you have tumors that have very high expression of CD30, so this is like Hodgkin lymphoma and anaplastic large cell lymphoma, the response rates are very high. In diseases where there is some positivity, you can still see response rates more in the 40% range. And then even if there is very modest or almost no CD30 expression, some of the trials have still shown benefit in about 20 to 30% of patients.
So I see this lady received romidepsin. I'm curious what your clinical experience is with it, and also pralatrexate.
So romidepsin and pralatrexate are both agents that are approved in relapsed patients with peripheral T-cell lymphoma. So those are go-to agents, as well as belinostat, in this population of patients. Our personal practice is to use romidepsin first, and part of that is just it's well tolerated. The response rates are kind of in the 30 to 35% range, and in patients who benefit from this treatment, they can actually remain on the treatment for quite a long time. Pralatrexate is also effective, similar response rates, but are a little more difficult to give. Some of the issues around mucositis, although if you prep the patients well, you can avoid that. And also lower blood counts and so on makes that a little bit more of a difficult agent. So we typically will give romidepsin as the first choice and then circle back to pralatrexate as a subsequent choice.
What about belinostat?
I think that belinostat is actually very similar in its efficacy to romidepsin. Sometimes you potentially could use it in patients who have low platelet counts because it doesn't have quite the same effect on platelets. But I think in general, that's an agent that is very similar. And if you've used romidepsin, I don't think you get quite as much from belinostat. So I think those are somewhat interchangeable.
Can you talk about your initial treatment strategy nowadays to peripheral T-cell lymphoma? And again, what kinds of trials and research concepts you think are exciting, if any?
Well, we just spoke about these new agents, and there have been a number of trials to try and take pralatrexate, belinostat, and romidepsin into the front line. Taking pralatrexate into the front line was challenging initially because it was tried in an alternating regimen where they used a CHOP-like or CHOEP treatment alternating with pralatrexate, and that didn't seem to be better than CHOP-based chemotherapy alone. But now there are a number of trials using pralatrexate plus CHOP, romidepsin plus CHOP, belinostat plus CHOP, really trying to look to see if one can increase the efficacy without increasing the toxicity unduly. And so far that's proved to be feasible. We're waiting now for longer-term follow-up to see whether it really is better than we would have expected from a CHOP or CHOEP-based regimen.
I want to ask you a little bit about mantle cell lymphoma. Again, in terms of what's come out recently that you think is important for clinicians in practice to know about?
I think mantle cell lymphoma is a field that has become quite complicated. It used to be pretty straightforward, but now as new agents and exciting data are coming out, it's getting increasingly complicated. So what I mean by that is there are agents such as lenalidomide, ibrutinib, in combination with rituximab, which have really shown significant efficacy in patients, even in frontline therapy. And so this is in contrast to a much more aggressive approach, which we've used in the past, using ARA-C or CHOP alternating with DHAP regimens followed by a transplant. So I think one of the questions that's going to be asked in upcoming trials is, do you even need to go down this very aggressive approach with a transplant if patients have a good response to their initial therapy? I think the other thing that's also becoming an important question is, how well can patients do with maintenance therapy? So there's evidence to say that rituximab used after a transplant or rituximab used after chemotherapy give patients very durable remissions. So again, our thinking in the past was just hit it hard, get a good deep remission, and it will be durable. That's now being called to question because we may be able to get good remissions with lesser therapy and then with a maintenance approach and still get good results. So that's going to require randomized trials to test that.
Curious about your thoughts about the treatment of relapse refractory disease. There are three approved therapies with ibrutinib, lenalidomide, and bortezomib, and another that we're starting to hear a lot about, venetoclax, which is approved in CLL. Can you talk about your experience with these four types of approaches and how you utilize them?
The interesting and exciting thing is that all of those agents really have quite significant activity. But I think, personally, the responses to ibrutinib in mantle cell patients have been quite impressive, well-tolerated, and in the patients who benefit, really have been significant benefit for patients overall. Durability not quite as good as seen in CLL, but certainly quite promising and quite satisfactory. I think one has to remember that bortezomib is still an effective agent, particularly if one uses it subcutaneously and avoids some of the toxicity issues, that's still something that is effective. But I would say in our practice, bortezomib and lenalidomide, both are agents that are effective, but we tend to use them after ibrutinib because of the fact that ibrutinib responses are high and the durability is reasonable and the toxicity profile is reasonable as well.
What about venetoclax? Is this something, have you accessed it outside a trial setting for your patients or would you?
Right now in our practice, it's typically used strictly within trial setting, so we haven't really done that. But I will say that the efficacy is looking very promising, and this is a disease that I think there's a lot of hope and promise for, and so I think venetoclax is a very effective therapy. But I think our practice, and we always encourage people to test things within the context of a clinical trial, because that really allows us then use that data to move the field forward.
So you mentioned the efficacy of ibrutinib, and we know from, you know, just asking people and taking polls and doing surveys that it usually is the first systemic therapy that's used rather than the others. But one of the issues that's come out about ibrutinib has been complications. And I'm curious, both with CLL, mantle cell, or any other place you've used ibrutinib, what your experience has been, particularly with bleeding and atrial fibrillation.
So I do think those are issues that do come up. And I think as one uses these agents more broadly, clearly they are not then clinical trial patients. And so the likelihood of these side effects and toxicities is greater. We do certainly see bruising and bleeding that happens. Although, to be honest, the bruising is unpleasant and causes visual concern. There haven't been the kind of devastating systemic kind of bleeding problems at all. So it's more kind of, you know, get a big blotch on your arm, kind of an ecchymotic lesion. And so creates anxiety, but I don't think is as much of an issue. We've tried to encourage people to be very careful about use in combination with warfarin, use in combination with other agents that would potentially put patients at risk. But as trial data comes out, there are data now showing that one can combine these agents even on patients that are on warfarin or low molecular weight heparin or aspirin. But again, I think that's best tested within the context of a clinical trial.
I have seen some work suggesting that maybe a fair number of people get taken off ibrutinib, particularly older people, because of complications. Globally, when you think about using this drug, what are you thinking is the likelihood that you're going to have enough of a problem that you're going to either think about stopping it or stop it?
Well, one of the things that I think hasn't been tested and we've started to do a little bit more of as we're treating patients off trials is, you know, we use either 4 pills or 3 pills, depending on which disease you're treating, as kind of the standard because that's what was tested in trials and that's what gave the high response rates in the rapidity that it was seen. But I don't know that that has to be the answer. I treat a fair number of patients with Waldenstrom's, and we see patients who have Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia and get a decrease in their dose, even down to 1 to 2 pills, and continue to have very nice responses and tolerate it well. So one thing that also could be explored would actually be to decrease the dose and even decrease the frequency sometimes of the dosing. You know, in other words, skip a day or skip a few days if you have toxicity. That's not been tested in a clinical trial, but I think certainly, do you need to have 100% BTK blockade or do you just need some BTK inhibition to get the same result?
How do they decide whether you or Mari Gertz use the Waldenstrom's?
So actually, we were a center of referrals. So actually, Prashant Kapoor is yet another person who sees the Waldenstrom. So we see enough people to share them around.
Wow, that's amazing. As long as we're talking about it, is there anything in particular about Waldenstrom's that makes more of a problem with ibrutinib?
Well, it's interesting. So Waldenstrom's, actually one of the features of treating with ibrutinib is you get a rapid decrease in the IgM level, and you interestingly get an increase in the hemoglobin. So many of these patients are quite anemic, and one of the things that's pretty impressive about this agent is that the anemia resolves. The challenge, however, is if you stop the drug, even for just a week or two, you get quite a substantial rebound in the IgM.
Wow.
And so it comes back quite quickly. So you need to be aware of that if you have a patient going for surgery, for example, that you need to keep your eye on the IgM because it can come back quite quickly. And I think the one other thing that's been curious is that if you actually do a bone marrow, the number of bone marrow cells or tumor cells in the bone marrow hasn't decreased in the same proportion as what you see the IgM decrease. So I think we don't understand BTK inhibition in Waldenstrom's quite that well. I think it's doing a lot of things to, again, the bone marrow environment, which allows for the bone marrow to have greater increase in the hemoglobin and decrease in the IgM, but it doesn't have quite the same direct effect on the tumor cells, at least not initially.
That's really fascinating. What do you do with a Waldenstrom's patient on ibrutinib who needs major surgery? How long before do you stop and when do you restart?
So in general, we've stopped about 1 to 2 weeks, 2 weeks preferably, ahead of the procedure, and then waited at least sort of 5 to 7 days post-procedure. It depends on what the procedure was. If the procedure was really a major procedure, we would do that. Many of these patients are in pretty reasonable remissions at that point, so actually you've got a little bit of time on your hands.